So the question we're looking at is, why do I find it hard to believe? This is a question that our friends asked. So what we did, we went out and we talked to our friends, neighbours, work colleagues. We said, if you met God or if you could talk to God, what's one question you would ask? There's a whole list of questions and we took the top three. Last week we looked at why. Why anything? And this week, the second top question that people asked was, why do I find it hard to believe? Why do I find it hard to believe? Straight away you can see it's going to be a tough question because it's a deeply personal question, isn't it? And it's not that there aren't good responses to the questions or the things that are behind a person's unbelief, but it's going to be a deeply personal thing. And there are all kinds of things that each person has had happen to them. They've had positive and negative experiences. They've had things that they've thought about. So there's all kinds of things that might contribute to why someone mightn't believe, and each person's going to be different. So it's deeply personal, but I think there are some common factors as to why we find it hard to believe. Some common categories that cause or might be behind why a person struggles to believe. And so I want to describe those factors, those sets of factors today. And by doing that, by condensing down someone's issues into a box, I don't mean to be simplistic. I don't want you to think that I am not doing justice to the complexity of the concerns that you have. I don't want to minimise what can be a deeply felt issue for you. So I don't want to be simplistic, but I hope to be helpful. So we'll look at those factors in a minute, but before we start, I need to say we won't get anywhere unless we're honest. Unless we're honest and we have integrity. So when I sit down and talk with someone about Jesus and about life, I want to try and be as completely honest as I can. I want to be honest about myself, my mistakes, my own journey, the questions that I still have. And I want to invite them to be honest as well. And not just honest about their thoughts, but honest about what's motivating them. So when you come to talk about something as personal and as deeply significant as faith, it touches on raw nerves. It touches on something that's deep and that often doesn't come out. It's not like you're just talking about the weather. So we've had a lot of rain lately, haven't we? The reason we talk about the weather is because it's easy to talk about and it doesn't touch on the raw stuff. It's deep. And because we touch on things that are deep when we're talking about faith, people get a bit passionate, or they might get a bit defensive, or they might withdraw. You remember Shrek? Onions have layers, ogres have layers. Well, people have layers too. And we tend to exist on the brown, crusty outside and not really dig down into the inner core that can kind of make us cry sometimes. Unless you hold a piece of bread in your mouth while you're cutting onions. You try that. So deep things, deeply personal things can be difficult to talk about. So we're not only talking about thoughts and questions, we're talking about motives, things that influence us. Perhaps I can illustrate it this way. Have you ever had an argument with your husband or wife or brother or sister? Perhaps you're not like me. Yeah, thanks for the honesty. That's what we wanted. You two shouldn't have had arguments. No. You have an argument, something's happened, and it's touched a raw nerve. It's been a difficult situation, and it's caused each other hurt. Yeah? Imagine the situation, probably not that hard to imagine. I only have to go back to yesterday to remember this. You want them to see your point. They want you to see their point. You retell the incident and say, no, this happened and I said this and you said that, and then they say, no, you said this and did that. And each person is trying to get the other person to see their perspective. And you don't think they get yours. And you're trying to get them to understand, and you keep retelling the incident, and you're pointing out the things that they obviously don't see. You ever done that? You ever been there? Now, that's not the point of what I'm about to say. The point is the next bit. Have you ever been in that situation? You've retold the story over and over again, and suddenly you have this moment of realisation where you go, they actually do get it. Yeah? They do get what I'm saying. That's the hard bit. Because when you realise that they do get it, and it's not really the facts of the case that or the situation that matter, what's actually going on is these hidden emotional motives that you have. These kind of, I just want you to know how the pain I felt. That's what's going on. They get the facts, but do they get how much it hurt? Yeah? That point, when you get to that moment of realisation, that point is challenging. Because at that point, it calls for honesty and integrity. At that point, when you realise she understands, then I don't need to keep making this point. I can let it go now. I need to be honest about what's motivating me and willing, once that's been understood, to let it go. So the illustration there is a bit different than this situation, but the point is we need honesty. And I've used that example because as we look at these factors that lead to unbelief, we'll see that there are layers. Yeah? And these layers of factors each contribute to why we might find it hard to believe. And I'm not going to cover every factor. I'm not going to answer every question, obviously. But I've categorised it this way. Could have done it a lot of different ways. This is the way that I thought was helpful for today. These are groups of factors that might contribute to a person finding it hard to believe. They might have questions. They might have things that are deep feelings or motives. It might be because of the culture around them. And finally, because of issues of their will and their heart. So we're going to work our way through these. I'm going to pause about halfway for you to ask some questions and to give your head a rest. So let's have a look at questions first. You okay with this? There's lots of questions that we could ask, yeah? And there are lots of questions that you've got to work through in order to come to the point of accepting Jesus for who he claims to be. And last week we noted that as humans, it's one of our defining characteristics is to ask questions. So having answers to questions is important, yeah? And being able to ask those questions is really important. It is not the case, I can't say this clear enough, it is not the case that in becoming a Christian that you have to leave your brains in the car park. That's just not the case. You need to take the time to ask the questions and seek the answers, explore the answers that are given. So for me, I had some really big really big questions that stopped me from embracing belief. How do I know Jesus is real? How do I know the Bible is reliable? How do I know that Christianity is not just some psychologically convenient construct? How do I reconcile God and suffering, which we'll be talking about next week? These were some of my questions, and the list goes on. I could fill a page probably. And we don't have time to answer those questions for you. But I can say, along with many others, like Ben, that God has been gracious in answering the questions that I've had. There are good, solid answers to the questions that you have. There's two things I want to point out when we're talking about questions. The first one is this. Unlike any other world religion, Christianity invites critique and criticism. It invites questions. It is the most discussed, pulled apart, and dissected of the world faiths. And that happens from the level of discussions in the pub, or around a game of poker. A few guys got together and played poker last night. Or to the highest academic levels in university, etc. And this isn't a new thing. Christianity has invited honest investigation right from the word go. In the book of Acts, which is in the Bible, written by a guy named Luke, it records the first couple of decades of Christianity. Towards the end of the book of Acts, the Apostle Paul has been imprisoned and he's being asked to explain what's going on to a number of governors. He's eventually in front of a guy called Festus, and each time he's asked to give his story, he talks about Jesus. He talks about Jesus who was born, lived his life, died, rose again, and the effect that that's had on Paul's life. Each time he talks about that. I'm just going to put up the end of one of these conversations. He's talking to a guy called Festus, and he says, "I'm not insane, most excellent Festus," Paul replied. "What I'm saying is true and reasonable. The king is familiar with these things, and I can speak freely to him. I am convinced that none of this has escaped his notice because it was not done in a corner." The point is this: Christianity is not this thing that's just kind of hidden over in the corner. It's a public thing. You can critique it. You can analyse it. You can check it out. And that's what Paul was saying to this guy. You know this stuff, mate. Go and investigate it. He was inviting critique and criticism. In another letter, Paul writes to some of his friends in a town called Corinth, and he invites them to go and talk to people who actually witnessed the risen Jesus. They're still around. Go and talk to them. In John's first letter, he says, "We touched him, we heard him, we saw him. He was there." He's inviting critique, criticism. Investigate it. Go and check it out. So you've got to put right out of your mind that Christianity is forcing yourself to believe a whole bunch of stuff that may not be true. That's not what Christianity is. It's not merely a private set of beliefs that help you in the hard stuff of life. It is a set of beliefs that will help you in the hard stuff of life, but it's not merely that. Christianity is bolted down in the historical, verifiable life and claims of Jesus. Claims about life and claims about your life. And it's also a claim about his present reality as the resurrected king. So it can be investigated, and Jesus invites your inquiry. Sir William Ramsay was a Scottish historian. There's two Sir William Ramsays. That always used to confuse me. One's a chemist and the other one's a historian, and they both lived around the same time. Get that? Sir William Ramsay was a Scottish historian. About 60 years ago, he died. Early 1900s, widely held theory that the New Testament was unreliable, that it was actually written by the second century church. That was a theory that was getting around that had a lot of currency. And Ramsay himself wasn't interested in Christianity, and he himself considered the New Testament unreliable. He's a historian, and he was constructing a historical and geographical study of Asia Minor from the first century. So modern day, from Rome to Turkey. Yeah? And that was what he was doing. And he found in some areas that there was little historical data to go by. So he reluctantly, he turned to the New Testament to see if it had anything to offer. And what he found amazed him and surprised him. Not only was everything that he read completely verifiable and verified by the stuff that he already knew, the sheer amount of historical data in the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts just amazed him. He wrote, "I may fairly claim to have entered on this investigation without prejudice in favour of the conclusions which I shall now seek to justify to the reader. On the contrary, I began with a mind unfavourable to it. Luke's history," later on he wrote, "Luke's history is unsurpassed in respect to its trustworthiness, and Luke is a historian of the first rank. Not merely are his statements trustworthy, this author should be placed along with the very greatest of historians." Sir William Ramsay, after his investigations, became a Christian. There are many stories that we could talk about like this, but the point is this: Christianity invites investigation. If you follow the cookie crumbs, I'm sure you will get to the cookie. Yeah? So that's the first point. The second point I want to make is I want to encourage you to pursue your questions. What are the key questions you have? Write them down. Be honest about them. Sometimes it's a bit too easy, a bit too lazy, a bit too convenient just to have them all kind of floating around and never really pin them down and ask them. Talk to someone. Read a book. I'd encourage you, like William Ramsay, to be willing to test things out. So that's questions. We have lots of questions. And before we move on to the next section, a lot of people in our survey said part of the reason they find it hard to believe is because of this idea of parallel universes and the multiverse. Now, if you are after a little sleep, you can have one right now. I just want to deal with it quickly because it's worth dealing with. The idea is this, that maybe our universe is just one of many. And if it's one of many, then we don't really need a God because there just could be multiple. There could be lots of these things floating around in this thing called the multiverse. Yeah, and so that's one reason people give for saying, well, maybe there is no God. It offers a possible explanation to why our universe is here, kind of. But let me point out a few things. If you take God away, if there is no God, if there's no personal creator, then the biggest problem you have is, obviously, where did the universe come from? Yeah? And for these guys, there is no answer. So what they try and do is work out how something could have come from nothing. Yeah? Lawrence Krauss, who is a physicist at the moment in the US, he's been to Australia a number of times, written a book recently. He was on Q&A either last year or the year before. He's given it the best shot, I would suggest, of describing how something could come from nothing. And so what he's done is he's traced back and back and back to beyond the Big Bang, as it were, itself. And he says before out of the Big Bang came matter and time, before the Big Bang there was nothing except for these elementary forces and laws. No matter, no energy, no time, but the forces and laws themselves were enough in themselves to create something spontaneously. Now that's fine as a theory, perhaps, but as has been universally pointed out to Lawrence Krauss, what he calls nothing is actually still something. Forces and laws. Where did they come from? But that's what you need to do if there's no God. You need to keep pushing yourself back and back. The second problem people have if there's no God is to explain the sheer improbability that the universe exists and that life exists as we know it. It is incredibly improbable that we would be sitting here today. They talk about it in terms of the fine-tuning of the universe. And if you just bear with me a moment, I just want to describe three of these things. The fine-tuning of the universe. If the gravitational force constant, the ratio that exists between the amount of mass you have and the gravitational force that it exerts on another body of mass, if that was any different, the universe would not exist. If it was any greater than after the Big Bang, as it were, if it was any greater, then it would have gone out and then it would have just imploded again. If the gravitational force constant was any weaker than after the Big Bang, things just would have kept going and we wouldn't have life as we know it. The balance is just perfect. Zoom into an atom. You look in an atom and it has a nucleus and it has electrons that float around it. The ratio between the nuclear force constant and the electromagnetic constant is just right so that an atom will stay stable. Any weaker, the atom would fall apart. Any tighter, and it would implode. It's the second thing, part of fine-tuning. Third thing, life requires carbon. And the amount of carbon we have in the universe is actually surprising, that we have the amount of carbon that we have. And what they've worked out is that after the Big Bang, there was enough resonant energy available so that the elementary particles could fuse together and form hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon. Did I get that right? Yep. And so if there was more resonant energy, then it would have gone beyond carbon and we would have heaps of gold or something, one of the heavier elements. If there wasn't enough resonant energy, then we would have stopped at a universe made up of hydrogen. The fact that there was just the right amount means that we have abundance of carbon. I'll stop there. The list goes on. The sheer improbability of the universe. That's what I'm trying to get to you. Right? You got that bit? To get around this problem of the sheer improbability of the universe, the multiverse was thought up. The idea is this. Because the universe is incredibly improbable, our universe is incredibly improbable, what if our universe was just one amongst many? And there were heaps and heaps of these things that kind of pop up like bubbles and then disappear. Over time, time doesn't have a concept, but anyway, you bear with me. Over time, with millions and billions of these things, eventually a universe like ours would perhaps just happen to exist. That's where the idea of the multiverse came from. Do you get it? Possibly. If not, I'm sorry. I tried my best. Talk to me afterwards. But here's three problems with the idea of the multiverse. One, you've just kicked the can further down the road. Okay, so let's say there are all these multiverses, there's all these parallel universes. Where did they come from? You've just kicked the can further down the road. Second problem, there is absolutely no evidence at all for the idea of a multiverse. There's none other than the idea. And the third problem, and this is makes it even worse, there is no way we could ever know. There is no way to measure it. We can't measure outside of our universe. We can't check outside of our universe. There's no way we can check it. So it's an idea from pure speculation with no evidence and no way of checking it. Compare that with Christianity, which has a God that has revealed himself in history and invites investigation, and countless people have found credible. Do you see the contrast? All right. They're the questions section. I want to move on to feelings and motives. Take a deep breath. I'll move fairly quickly through these next two. Feelings may not be the right word to use. By feelings, I mean those hidden motives. I think you probably get what I'm saying already. The things on the interior, things that aren't necessarily rational causes for unbelief, but things that that get in the way of belief, or that we allow to get in the way of belief. And again, this could stem from a vast array of things, and I'll just give you some common examples. Perhaps there's hurt and disappointment from other Christians. A bit like what Joel was referring to earlier. Perhaps there's been personal hurt. Perhaps, and we all know stories now of people that have been hurt atrociously by people that would claim that they were Christians. And this hurt sets up deep feelings and motivations to resist Christianity. Or perhaps there's just disappointment. Look at some of those who are supposed to be fair dinkum followers of Jesus, and you're just disappointed. You're probably doing that with me. You're just not happy. And for me, this was a big issue. In my later teens and early 20s, I looked around at other Christians and at Christianity in general, and I was pretty disappointed. I don't want to be one of them, which is why my wife laughed when I became a pastor of a church. And in my head, I had good reasons for resisting Christianity. It was easy to point out Christians that somehow failed or were not what I considered good. So it was easy to point to them, but there was a deeper motive going on. I was driven by a kind of pride. A pride that kind of thought I was better. A pride which caused me to use others' failures as an excuse, except of accepting Jesus as he claimed and following his lead. A story I've heard, I think I might have relayed this to you, but and again, I don't know if it's true, but it works. It speaks to me. Pastor's talking to a guy, and a guy says, "Look, the problem with the church is full of hypocrites." Pastor says, "You're right, and there's room for one more." That speaks to me. So these feelings, these interior motives, cause us to resist faith in Jesus. Tim Keller, from that book that we just previewed before, he said Christianity felt Christianity seemed very unreal to me, though I was unable to discern a viable alternative or way of thought and life. I didn't know it at the time, but this spiritual unreality stemmed from three barriers that lay across my path. The first barrier was an intellectual one, questions. I was confronted with a host of tough questions about Christianity. I began to read books and arguments on both sides of these issues, and slowly but surely, Christianity began to make more and more sense. The second barrier was an interior or personal one. As a child, the plausibility of a faith can rest on the authority of others, but when you reach adulthood, there's need for a personal, first-hand experience. And whilst I'd said my prayers for years, and while I sometimes had those inspirational, aesthetic moments, that sense of wonder at the sight of the sea or the mountain, I'd never experienced God's presence personally. This required not so much knowledge of techniques for prayer, but a process in which I came to grips with my own needs, my flaws and problems. It was painful and was, as is typical, triggered by disappointments and failures. It would take another different kind of book to go into them, but it needs to be said that faith journeys are never simply intellectual exercises. It's so true, yeah? It's not merely an intellectual exercise. So these deep motives and feelings, they often lay in the background, they often don't see the light of day, and they are causes for unbelief rather than reasons. But they're there, and that's why we need to have honesty and integrity, because it can be too easy just to leave them there, too convenient to just leave them there. And so, like the argument you might have with your wife or husband or brother or sister, even after they've understood, we don't want to let it go. We need honesty and integrity. And there's a lot more we could say about that category. And we'll come back when we'll see how the four fit together. I just quickly want to look at culture. I'm feeling bad because I'm realising, gosh, there's a lot of information. Just quickly look at culture and then we'll pause for some questions. Culture is a huge third factor for unbelief. You may not realise the role culture plays in the decisions you make in your life. We have the sense that we are rational, independent, autonomous beings. I'm not influenced by others. I can make my own decisions about life. Yes, but not so. We are influenced by culture a lot. Last week we talked about worldviews and the dominant worldview of secularism, naturalism, and how that influences people in our society. Well, I just want to introduce you to a concept that helps. It's called plausibility structures. Really sorry, big words. Plausibility structures are a set of filters which we develop over time, and they help us decide things which are plausible, likely or not, and help us deal with information quickly. So if I found a bunch of cookies in my pantry and I thought, oh, Kath's cooked some yummy cookies. One of the kids come in and they say, no, some elves came and they dropped them off at the door and they said, Merry Christmas. My plausibility structure would say, no, that's not very plausible. I don't have to think about it much. I just disregard it, you know, goes through to the keeper. So plausibility structures act like filters. They filter out claims that we think are unreasonable, and they let in claims that we think are reasonable. But here's the thing, they don't tell us whether the claim is actually true or not. And often they can get it wrong. They only tell us whether a truth seems plausible. And they're useful for weeding out the bulldust, yeah? Or for without putting in too much effort, but they're dangerous, they're unhelpful, because they can prevent us from forming true beliefs about reality. Now, here's the thing. If we're in a culture that is fed a steady diet of secularism, naturalism, then the plausibility structures that we all have, our default position Rather than being to make an intelligent decision by an informed mind, it will be to be sceptical. Do you see that? That's the plausibility structure that any Western person has, is to be sceptical. What influence does that play? Well, it's just one of the factors that comes into why people might find it hard to believe. So there are questions, feelings, motives, there's culture. We're going to look at the will and the heart in a sec, but I just thought I'd pause. Perhaps you can say something that's been useful to someone near you, and then I'll give you a moment to ask questions if you've got them for now. Just a break. No worries. How about we press on? This part will be shorter, but in some ways it's the most important part. This is the issue of our will or our heart. The original question that our friends asked, if they were to meet God, their question, there's a certain kind of irony. If they met God, they'd say, why do I find it hard to believe? But there's two stories from the biographies of Jesus' life that really help to unpack this and illustrate the point. So if you've got a Bible, you could turn to Matthew chapter 19. I will be putting it on the screen, but I think the words will be a bit small. So Matthew chapter 19, verse 16. So Matthew is an account of Jesus' life, a biography, if you like. And we're just picking up one incident that happened in the life of Jesus. Chapter 19, verse 16. Just then a man came up to Jesus and asked, "Teacher, what good thing must I do to get eternal life?" "Why do you ask me about what is good?" Jesus replied. "There is only one who is good. If you want to enter life, keep the commandments." "Which ones?" he inquired. Jesus replied, "Well, you shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not give false testimony, honour your father and mother, and love your neighbour as yourself." "All these I've kept," the young man said. "What do I still lack?" Jesus answered, "If you want to be perfect, go, sell your possessions and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me." When the young man heard this, he went away sad because he had great wealth. Then Jesus said to his disciples, "Truly I tell you, it's hard for someone who is rich to enter the kingdom of heaven. Again I tell you, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for someone who is rich to enter the kingdom of God." When the disciples heard this, they were greatly astonished and asked, "Who then can be saved?" Jesus looked at them and said, "With man this is impossible, but with God all things are possible." Now, I don't have time to unpack this at great depth, but here's a man who seems to ask a pretty good question. How do I get eternal life? That's a good question to ask. Good question to ask Jesus. But he also seems to be a man who's pretty self-assured, yeah? He seems to be pretty confident that of his own goodness and his ability, his capacity to be good enough for God, yeah? "What good thing must I do?" That's what he asks. And Jesus sees the heart of the matter pretty quickly, I suspect. And he goes, "You know God's laws. How have you gone with those?" And Jesus actually only quotes some. And the man says, "I've done all these. What else?" And here's the crunch point. Like I said, Jesus sees the heart of the matter because he sees the guy's heart. He sees that his heart is not given to God. Not given to God and not given to the things God wants. His heart is wrapped in pride, in self-assurance, and in the self-assurance particularly that his wealth provides. And Jesus looks at him and he says, "If you want to be perfect, go, sell your possessions, give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me." And when the man heard this, he went away sad. What just happened in that story? Well, in this case, the issue that is visible is money. Yeah? But the issue beneath the visible issue is deeper than that. There's the level of feelings and motives, pride and self-assurance. Yeah? But then there's an issue that's even deeper still. And that's the issue of this guy's will or his heart. Here's the point. What stops people from believing in God? What stops them from responding in faith to Jesus? The core issue is the issue of their will or their heart. The fact that if we're going to believe in God and respond to Jesus, it means that I have to submit my will to his. It means that I have to let go of my pride and my self-assurance, my assurance in my own goodness, and I have to give my heart over to him. I have to respond to him, and the things that he says are important. Yeah? I have to accept God as God, personally. And that can be a hard thing. Yeah? I hope you don't mind, Ben. If Ben worked through his questions, he worked through all his concerns, but there was a point where he hovered as he contemplated the reality of bending his will to God, accepting, giving his heart to the reality of God revealed in Jesus. Now, this may seem insurmountable for you. Perhaps you're like this guy. Perhaps you're here today because you're interested in eternal life. You think the words of Jesus have something about them that matter. Something attracts you to Jesus. But to hear that this requires you to accept God as God, to hand over your self-assurance, if it means for you that it's going to affect the things that you hold dear, like your wealth, perhaps that seems insurmountable. And it did to Jesus' disciples too. Have a look at verse 25. When the disciples heard this, they were greatly astonished and asked, "Who then can be saved?"